and welcome to the first episode of Oracles of the Occult, a podcast run by your hosts, Corellia and Valkyrie. You and I both know that having some sort of, like, public domain to really talk about our occult practices and our opinions is something that we've kind of been looking forward to for, like, a really long time now. And we've been, like, talking about it for months now, but we never actually, like, had the opportunity to really go through with it. So I think this is a really wonderful opportunity, and I'm really excited to be sharing this with you.
I've always loved to be able to spread any word of the occult to communities. I've always loved engaging with other people online, and we're finally able to start that in a way. We're able to voice our opinions, talk about our beliefs, and just have fun doing it too, which is really awesome.
100%. So I'm sure we're going to have some viewers who are absolutely completely foreign to the idea of the occult, and I have a lot of experiences where the word occult on its own has a really negative connotation when I mention it to people. It's really difficult for me to go to someone and introduce myself as, like, hi, I'm an occultist, because when they think of occult, you know, a lot of things that pop into people's minds are like, oh, there's this satanic worshiper, and they really do acquaint, like, occult with, like, a space cult. But we're basically kind of here to quickly remove those misinformations and really introduce what the occult is all about. And to really get started on that, I've gathered a couple definitions on the occult and a couple definitions on the terms that you're going to hear a lot during this podcast. Like, first of all, occult defined by Google Dictionary is supernatural, mystical, or magical beliefs, practices, or phenomena, or a secret society to study alchemy and the occult, also known as the supernatural, the paranormal, magic, black magic, relating to like occult practices like voodoo. And so that's, like, a really quick rundown of what the occult is like. We specifically are probably gonna really center around, like, Western esoteric traditions and paradigms. The term esoteric itself means to something that is kind of, like, secret. And occult in a way also means hidden or secret, so you can kind of see the comparisons between exoteric and the term occult. They're both very hidden things, kind of like the hidden secret mysteries of the world, of religion, of philosophy, that are kind of hidden and not exoteric, which would be shown to the public. Because a lot of, like, occult stuff, we're not even gonna get to, like, the really crazy conspiracies, and that's, like, a really bare bones definition of the occult. Astrology, tarot, psychics, that all classifies under the occult because it's taboo. It's considered taboo in a lot. Well, with the rise of pop astrology and the rise of astrology in general, it's becoming less taboo, but in regards to how that fits in the context of, like, Christianity and, like, Islam, it's still pretty taboo. Now let's go into a little bit of, like, who we are. Valkyrie, would you like to start with, like, a couple things about yourself?
Sure. Well, I'm Valkyrie. You already know that. I go by all pronouns. I am a demonolater on the draconian path, and also a very dedicated Kemetic pagan. When it comes to my areas of study, I'm looking into occult philosophy, Solomonic magic, and just understanding Kemeticism as a whole, as I would still consider myself more of a beginner in the arena of Kemeticism.
That was a really wonderful introduction, and we're gonna go into a bit of our practice a little further into the podcast, where we're gonna be discussing a couple misconceptions within both our practices, because I think demonolatry and Kemeticism do have their similarities, but they're also very vastly different practices. And I think it's really interesting to kind of, like, delve into a bit of that while we have the time. So, hi, I'm Corellia. I go by she, they pronouns. I consider myself a traditional demonolater and a avid occultist. My areas of study basically include general Western esoteric occult, like, ranging from learning about Enochian magic, up to, like, Diane Fortune and Aleister Crowley, and, like, not Lon Milo Duquette and Donald Tyson, that kind of beat. But, of course, also just general, like, draconian tradition, demonolatry, a little bit of angelolatry, and that's about it. So, to really understand, because we've thrown in a lot of new terms. Not a lot of people know what Cometicism or demonolatry is, so I'm gonna quickly like just define what demonolatry is, and then I'm gonna have Valkyrie explain what Cometicism is. Demonolatry is essentially, by definition, it's the worship of demons, and it's kind of stemming off of what demonology is. Demonology, which is the study of demons, demonolatry is the worship of demons, or umbrellaed as like the working with demons, because in a lot of pagan traditions, you'll see a lot of pagans that are witches that like are occultists that work with these external entities that can be seen in a very atheistic light, but a fair amount of like practitioners that I meet are theists at heart. And demonolatry is working alongside the entities that we've named demons. And I will go into a bit of misconceptions, and because I know that's like a really scary term when people first hear it, but we're gonna go into that. Valkyrie, why don't you explain a bit about Cometicism?
Okay, so very generally, Cometicism could be called Egyptian paganism. It is the worship and/or working with of ancient Egyptian deities. People might already know deities like Ra, Anubis. Those are some pretty big figures within the community. But Cometicism also has a lot to do with Heka, which is ancient Egyptian magical practices. Within the religion of Cometicism, it is pretty much a, it is very required that you respect and follow the religious doctrines known as the 42 laws of Maat. So yeah, Cometicism is just like worshiping, working with ancient Egyptian deities, the practice of Heka, ancient Egyptian magic, and following their religious doctrines.
This is a genuine question that I have. Where did the term Cometicism come from? Because I have a friend who like writes a lot of like mythology books, or like very Percy Jackson style books. And he didn't know that Egyptian paganism was referred to as Cometicism. And I just want to know, is it more appropriate to call it Cometicism or like Egyptian paganism? And where exactly did the term Cometic come from?
So, Romanized ancient Egyptian. So, Romanized means like turned into English, like how if you were reading something that would be in Korean, but they wrote it with like the English language, that would be Romanized. So, the Romanized ancient Egyptian word for ancient Egypt, back in the time of that empire, Egypt was called Kemet, which means like land of the black earth, referring to their like the rich soils in many parts of Egypt. So Kemet is the word for Egypt, and Kemeticism, it's just like referring to the working with of like the religions of Egypt and the magical practices of ancient Egypt. So I'd say that it's fine to call it ancient Egyptian paganism or Egyptian paganism. That would be fine, but if you want to just maybe like respect the culture a little bit more, respect its origins, respect where this religion bloomed, then you would call it Cometicism.
Is that like kind of like a similar take to like Greek paganism versus Hellenic paganism?
Yeah, yes.
So that's really interesting. Next up, we're gonna move on. Like I said earlier, we're gonna talk about a couple misconceptions in demonolatry. Once I get to Cometicism, I'll kind of let Valkyrie do their own thing. But I know demonolatry is like kind of both of our fields of expertise, so I guess we both can definitely talk about that. So one of the first misconceptions that we hear a lot, especially because Valkyrie and I are both moderators, and we've been like, and we're pretty active on like a couple like communities, and in like one of the communities that we're in, we're constantly met with like people who are just learning about demonolatry for the first time ever. And sometimes we have some interesting reactions. A lot of the times it's really nice. It's people that are really interested and are just looking for resources and books to start reading. Some other times we get screamed at by people that are unhappy with our practice.
Oh yeah, all the time.
So eventually I think one of our friends had to make an entire like post to clear everything up about basic misconceptions with the demonic. and the demonic divine. So first of all, the very basic misconception, demons are evil, bad, and out to hurt you. Is this true, Valkyrie?
No, it is not. I've met so many beginners, you know, like you said, we've met so many people who are just coming into the practice. And yeah, we've met so many people who are so respectful, so interested, so happy to learn, and people who are just like so appreciative of the demonic divine. But then I've met just as many beginners who are absolutely terrified, mostly because of an Abrahamic upbringing or just how they've experienced demons through their portrayal in modern media. A lot of people are just terrified that these demons are going to hurt them in the end, that they're going to end up, burning in hell once they die, like, you know, fire and brimstone. And a lot of people are just absolutely very, very scared of the practice. Even some people I know who have worked with demons before, like a friend of mine has worked with Leviathan, but they're still absolutely terrified of almost every other demon. And that fear runs so, so deep, because just within media, within horror movies, comics, books, like even just our language, just everything, demonic, infernal, it's all just like pure evil and the absolute worst thing you could imagine.
Yeah, I think people do undermine the amount of effect religious trauma has on a person. Especially, what's funny is that there's a lot of demonologists that I know that are either still closeted or are raised in Christian households. Like, I'm raised in a very, I was raised with a very Catholic lifestyle. I'm really lucky that, like, my guardians are very, very supportive of my practice now. But I don't think this was definitely not what they were expecting, you know? I went to Sunday school, I sang in the choir, and I was so excited to go to the choir, like, every weekend. I went to church twice a week because my Sunday school was on a Saturday. So we could learn on Saturday and then go to church again on Sunday. And I hated it. And we also, like, I know you also have a very, like, Christian Catholic past. Like, you went to was it a Christian or a Catholic school?
I went to a Christian school all the way up until 6th grade, and then I transferred to a Catholic school in 7th and 8th grade. So yeah, extremely Christian upbringing. At the Catholic school, our principal was a nun, a very scary woman as well. So we were just like surrounded in like Christianity and Catholicism. We'd have chapel every month at the Christian school. Every morning we'd sing to the Lord. In my Catholic school, we had a 9-foot-tall statue of Joseph, Jesus's father, in one of the main halls. And we had a statue of Mary in every single classroom. So yeah, a lot. We were like really bathed in Christianity.
That's not saying it's like a terrible religion. I think it's a gorgeous religion. I just think like people have, it's very misinterpreted is all, but like I know Christo-pagans, and we definitely have our, like, have interacted with really nice Christian witches and Christian pagans before and had like nothing but amazing experiences with them. They're really open-minded sometimes. And so it's, as demonologists, we understand that our existence essentially is very against, our existence is essentially the most taboo thing you could.
Oh, yeah.
But that doesn't change our respect for people that are part of that religion. And I think that's one of the problems that we could definitely go into in another episode about how the community is a bit iffy. There's a bit of an anti-Abrahamic bias that's kind of always going to be there in the pagan community. And that's because a lot of it is unresolved religious trauma. And that's... It's not fair to put the blame game to play the blame game and blame it on someone, because it's not usually always entirely one party's fault. But essentially, demons, we wouldn't call them evil, because in history, a lot of demonic names can literally legitimately be traced to pagan deities. Like, for example, we have Astarte. Is it a Canaanite deity? Is it a Canaanite or Mesopotamian? And which has transferred to a number of hierarchies, like one of the 7 deadly sins hierarchies. I forgot whose hierarchy it was. It wasn't Binsfield, but Astaroth was featured in there. And then we have the Ars Goetia, the Lesser Key of Solomon, which again features Astaroth in there, and Astaroth can easily be traced to Astarte. And then we have like Baal, for example, or Baal, King Baal of the Goetia, can easily be traced to the Canaanite deity Baal. And also, Baal essentially meant Lord, and so in a lot of like really old pagan religions, Canaanite Mesopotamian, there was a lot of deities that went by the name Baal, like Baal Hadad. I'm definitely tarnishing the name here, so bear with me. And there's a lot of demons that, and not every demon has traces to like a deific mask, but a fair amount of them do, to the point where it's really like questionable to say that they're evil when they have like a deific mask, you know? And also, there is this thing when it comes to Christianity and very monotheistic religions, right-hand path religions, that good and evil are objective. And that is absolutely, in the occult, that is not true at all. Good and evil, for most of us, for about every occultist that I talk to, is very subjective. Of course, we have like a moral consensus and like a common moral compass. But when it comes to defining good and evil, we, on the left-hand path, we do not let other people define that for us. We kind of have to define it on our own. And so while one person could see demons as amazing, great, another person could see them as absolutely terrible. And that could apply to any situation, to any entity, to any person. And I think people don't always understand the subjectivity. Like, a cult itself is super subjective. And I know that Anton LaVey, the founder of Satanism, atheistic Satanism, really targets a lot of like spiritual practices by saying it's too subjective, there is no objectivity. In a way, I really have to like continue analyzing that the Satanic Bible. But he's right. There is a lot of subjectivity in the occult, and you can't really run away from it. But that kind of just is a very key point to understanding why demons aren't evil. Maybe to like another practitioner, they could be evil. Sure. If you have enough experiences with the demonic that are genuinely that negative, then yeah, maybe you do have the right to call them evil, but not everyone does. Just because, like, that's the thing. I really pride myself on this idea of guilty until proven otherwise by myself individually. Like, I have to see it when it comes to spiritual things. I have to see it with my own eyes to believe it for me. But someone else's truth, like, it's like someone else's truth does not have to be my truth, and my truth in no way, shape, or form has to be someone else's truth. Truth is subjective. Like, beauty is in the eye of the beholder, like the first law of the Kybalion, the law of mentalism, which is basically saying, according to this universal law, everything we see and experience in our physical world has its origin in the invisible or mental world. As within, so without, as we believe, so it manifests. Basically, all that we see is like, it's in our head. Everything is in our head. And it was mind-breaking when I was first reading this. This is one of my first occult books that I ever picked up on, which I now realize is not a good example of a hermetic philosophy, the Kybalion. Instead, you should be reading the Corpus Hermeticum and the Hermetica, because those are definitely much more informative when it comes to what hermetic philosophy is really is at its core, without the like New Age nuance. So yes, are demons bad? No. Yes, no. It's subjective. Can demons hurt you? That is a very interesting topic.
I mean, as someone who absolutely, like, it's very obviously I love the demonic divine. I appreciate them so much. Do I think they can hurt you? Yes, I do think that they can. But like, do they want to hurt you? I think that they have the power, to hurt you, because I've seen their power within my life, just bringing people into my life. For me to learn from, just like removing people from my life who are very toxic, and just the amount of effect that I've seen them have on my life, makes me pretty confident in the fact that they could hurt me in some way if they wanted to. but I don't think that they go out of their way to hurt anybody unless there's like an extremely good and actual reason for them to hurt somebody. So I think that they absolutely have the power just by seeing how much effect they've had on my life, on other people's lives, just like in invoking a demon for help with something and just seeing like how amazingly and how drastically they're able to change a situation when I call on them for help makes me think that absolutely, yeah, they could hurt someone if they wanted to.
I think one of the topics that we need to cover is, will demons protect you? Like, are they willing to hurt other people in order to protect those that they care about? Of course. It's loyalty. It's basic loyalty. I've definitely heard of accounts of the demonic attacking people who try to harm, like, the practitioners that are loyal to them without the practitioners having to do anything, having to say anything. I've seen them step into situations in my life and in other people's lives without even being asked. I always thought that the demonic really do pride themselves on loyalty. Like, keeping up to the end of your bargains is like that's very much correct. It's a very correct stigma with the demonic. Not necessarily stigma, but I think that they definitely will step in to protect you if you are loyal to them, and if you have proven your loyalty to them. And that is in my gnosis. That is my truth. That does not have to apply to anybody else. But they're definitely not out to hurt you for the sake of hurting you unless you've prompted it.
I can't really imagine a scenario in which someone who works with demons would get really hurt by them. Unless, I don't know, unless you like you did something legitimately horrible to another person, then of course I would absolutely see a demon that you work with coming for you and teaching you a lesson. And speaking of the demonic stepping in to help those who they work with when somebody attacks them, I have experienced that firsthand.
The second misconception that we're going to talk about is the conjuration of demons and summoning demons. Very
Ooh.
interesting. I joke, and I think that if you're in like the occult, if you're in that practice, it's completely comfortable for you to make jokes like, I'm going to sell my soul to Satan, because like I do that.
Yeah.
Sometimes, yeah, I think it's funny, but I won't actually. Like, it's completely a joke. The term summoning means forced, and we see those sort of terms, like, or those sort of like concepts come up in like the Lesser Keys of Solomon, which wasn't even like written by Solomon, but it supposedly said like, oh, he conjured demons by buying 1,500 materials. And like this brass ring that had a sigil stamped on it. But essentially, you'll see in a lot of like older grimoires and like demonic grimoires, definitely you're gonna hear the words summoning and conjuring. And part of that could probably be to support Christianity, because any other term, I'm guessing, would have made that grimoire very questionable. And it'd be very difficult for the magician, you know, which makes complete sense. But in modern day terms, we typically don't refer to summoning. We don't summon traditional demon altars, at least, and most general modern demon altars don't really summon demons, because we see it as forceful, and we want to treat the divine and the demonic divine as like, you know, guests, not I'm going to drag you out of nowhere and force you to come in to my circle. Even though like my belief is that that's not actually possible. You can't really force them to like. You can't really drag them in.
Yeah, I'd like to comment that I also don't believe that it's possible to force a divinity to appear. You can't force them to do anything. And that always makes me question when people do believe that they can like summon and bend these demons to their will. I just think, why would you want the help or the aid of a spirit that can be so easily manipulated by another human? Why would you want their help? Why would you want to work with them if they're so easily overcome and they're so easily vanquished? I just feel like it would just aid your practice even more if you were like, instead of working with these spirits that just anybody could ward off, anybody could bend to their will, anybody could control, if instead of like viewing them as that, like why not work with powerful divinities who in exchange for your loyalty and respect, will in return be extremely loyal to you, help you out so much in your craft, and just be such a positive influence on your life.
Yeah, I think one of the like exceptions that I'll put to that is if it's part of your religious tradition to do that, go figure, man. But like, don't push it on other people, and don't like know that that's only like for people within your tradition. And I know some people who do it in like a metaphorical sense, summoning as like gaining back power, and I think that's completely like fine. To be honest, I really think it's fine, because some people like will do that as a form of gaining your power, but they won't like outwardly disrespect the demons. Like, remember that time we had that one dude come into our community, and he was like, "I pissed on Duke Agarus's altar,
I know. Like,
and
haven't you
now I'm
watched enough horror
like."
movies to know that you shouldn't piss on the altar of a demon? Oh my God.
In which, in that case, yes, you definitely deserve to get the stroke of bad luck that you were getting for that. That was disrespectful, and I'm pretty sure the demon saw that and then was like, "All right, well, yeah." But essentially, we use the terms invocation and evocation, which are very misused. It's different. Like, Connolly's The Complete Book of Demonology says that there's a different definition for ceremonial magicians versus non like traditional demonologists. I personally use evocation because by definition it's what makes the most sense for me, and I could go into a bit more detail about like why, because the book itself is a bit flawed in definition, because it uses it defines invoke and evoke from two different sources and not the same sources, one from like Wikipedia and one from just Google definitions. But if you look to the same source, if you look at the same definition for invoke and evoke on like, was it Google definition, you'll get the same meaning. So I personally don't really see the difference. So I use the term evoke in a very ceremonial sense too. I see invoke as like calling the divine within you, and then evoke in a when you're doing it with the demonic is kind of just like not having the energy in you, but having the energy outside you, maybe because you can't handle it, maybe because you feel very uncomfortable and you still want to get used to it, maybe because you're meeting an entity for the first time and you don't want to end up inviting something negative by accident and having that go into you instantly. I personally like because I usually really do workings with entities that I'm really comfortable with, and demons that I'm vetted, I feel very comfortable around. I invoke them immediately with absolutely no issues. And but when I'm talking to someone completely new, I prefer to evoke them. And like, people use the term evoke with the dead. I don't think evocation is disrespectful at all, because if we're saying evocation is disrespectful, then why do we do that to the dead? And when we know that in a lot of necromantic works, we're still supposed to respect and honor the dead. In a lot of traditions, we respect and honor the dead as well. And so I really just like think there's a lot of, I think that again, it's subjective. Personally, I feel like it should be kind of objective looking at the basic Google definition, and when you do your actual research, it's objective in like some lights, but eventually you're gonna get your own kind of like definitions about it. And so at the end of the day, it's subjective because it is magical and it's completely based off gnosis and your like your experience.
I do think that for beginners, for those who are just coming into the practice, there should be a much better objective definition. Because I've seen some people, if I say I like evoked a demon, they'll get mad because they see evocation as disrespectful.
Yeah. Just because like one book told them to,
I
and I'm
know,
like,
yeah.
but you should read into it and cross-reference. And that isn't in any way to hate S. Connolly's work. You of course know that I love S. Connolly. I love reading her works. But there's just that one tidbit of information. It's things, everything is worth trying to cross-reference and trying to understand where it came from. And then once you are able to like really use like external information to understand and clarify your own point, then you can argue with it against other people. And you can argue with it with a lot more confidence, a lot more evidence too.
And again, with S. Connolly's work, I've seen so many people, like in occult communities, like on TikTok also, when somebody asks, like I've seen this maybe like 5 or 6 times. Somebody will ask, like, what are some beginner books you recommend for demonolatry? And of course, they always recommend The Complete Book of Demonolatry by S. Connolly. And they say it's a great book, but they always say, but don't listen to her notes on invocation and evocation. And it's like, yeah, her definitions aren't great, but I've never seen them give a reason as to why you're not supposed to listen to her definition. And they never give an alternate source to look at for a definition. And they never give like an actual definition. So I think that's just really confusing for beginners as well, because it's like, don't listen to this person's notes on evocation and invocation, but then where are you supposed to go? Why am I not supposed to listen to it? And like, what is the actual definition of these two things?
Our third misconception is sacrifices. We'll hear it a lot where we get this misconception that we need to sacrifice a chicken or a child, but that is absolutely not true. Even in the Satanic Bible, LaVey makes it very clear. He's like, we do not sacrifice living animals that are not ourselves. And even then, like, should be really careful about what we sacrifice within, like, our physical selves. The demonic, yes, they're known for petitions and bargains and deals. That is definitely something that applies even to modern day demonolaters. And we make sure to really like keep our, we always make sure to keep our end of the bargains, which, speaking of which, I have to do my offerings. Thank you for reminding me. offerings, that sounds very scary. What are you talking about? I'm like, okay, well, I'm just giving like a stick of cinnamon, flowers, pine cones, an egg. Maybe an egg is like the closest I'll ever get to like a live thing. It's a raw egg. Chocolate, dirt, coins, those can all classify as offerings. And they're also like energetic devotional offerings, like researching for Lucifer, because Lucifer is the demon of enlightenment, so we research and we study for him, or I do homework for him, you know? Or I do some, I perform self-love as a dedication offering to Astaroth, the demon or demoness of love. Or I stand up to myself, I stand up against my bullies, as a devotional act for Belial, the one without a master. Like, all of those could, sacrifices are so, again, subjective, which you're gonna see everywhere. And anyone who's like friends with me for long enough knows I get super annoying because I always bring up subjectivity in about every argument. But it is really subjective, and sacrifices can, but sacrifices are not live animals. If they are sacrificing live animals and live people, they are not a demonolater. I can assure you that, and they are not like a Satanist either, because that's blatantly against the rules. And it's just like your moral compass has to be really estranged for that to happen. Because while that was possibly like okay back in the day, it's not okay in a modern Western esoteric context.
And I don't think that the demonic would be happy at all if you killed someone for them, or if you killed a child for them, or you threw like a freshly killed chicken just on their altar. I don't think they'd be too happy about that. Because it's like what am I gonna do with this dead body? Thanks, I guess. I would have preferred a glass of wine. But yeah, the demonic don't appreciate offerings like that. But when it comes to sacrificing a human body, like Corellia said, before, you really only sacrifice yourself. But what does that mean exactly? No, it's not like self-mutilation or anything like that. Sacrificing yourself, could also just be like, devotional acts, or channeling their energy, or meditating with them to gain gnosis, or, which is also a bit controversial in some areas, but it's become much more widely accepted. Offering your own blood to a demon. And the reason you're supposed to be so careful with that is because your blood is you. It is your life force. It is something that you cannot live without. It is you. It is your soul. And when giving it to a demon, you're giving them part of yourself. You're giving up yourself to them. And when people give blood, it's not like there's absolutely no mutilation. If people have, female anatomy, it's actually recommended that they use their menstrual blood. And if people don't want to use that, or they don't have the anatomy that supplies menstrual blood, then you just prick your finger. Because really, all the demonic need is like a drop of blood. They don't need like a gallon. Just like a drop of blood is enough for like a really big blood offering.
Speaking of like on deals and bargains, so I'm East Asian. I'm very much raised in a pretty Asian household. I was raised in Asia. My cousins, like I have a lot of my family members are like natural mediums, and I was talking to one of them the other day because they came over like a month ago, and we were talking about like our practice, and she was talking to me about the demons because I was like, yeah, I work with demons, and she's like, that's cool, just don't make any deals or bargains or petitions with them. And I was like, why not? And I think like even within mediums, there's a lot, even within the occult community and paying community, there's a lot of people that are still very closed-minded when it comes to like working with the demonic alone. And there wasn't really much I could say to that other than like, yeah, I mean, I'm very careful. But you need to understand that I have devoted so much time and effort to researching, to talking to other sources, whereas like I'm not disregarding your ability at all. I'm just disregarding the fact that I know for a fact you haven't really researched anything close to left-hand path, like occult text. And so I was just kind of like, hi, well, I understand your concern. I completely understand your concern. It's a very foreign subject. But you have to understand that I know what I'm getting into. I'm very well researched. I have like the right people looking out for me. Like I when it comes to bargaining with the demonic, yeah, I do that a fair amount because it works, and I don't have any backfires for it because I go through with what I say I'm gonna do. But that's kind of like my experience. Like it's you're gonna find conservatives, especially with the demonic. It's such like, and like very new age spiritualists would be terrified. A good amount of them have been terrified to learn about the demonic side. And yet that's because like misconceptions of the demonic, the terrible like Hollywood imagery of us, and also religious trauma. But that's essentially like a really short stuff. And I think the fourth misconception is the worship of the demonic. Because demonolatry literally means worshiping the demonic or worship of the demonic. And we are a left-hand path practice. Like most of us are pretty left-hand path. And with that comes this idea of we don't worship anyone but ourselves, but I have my own like definitions. For me, I've always Well, there was a point in the beginning of my practice where I was like, oh, I'm never gonna worship anyone but myself. And here I am worshiping the demonic. Like, how did that happen? And it basically happened because if you look at the definition of worship, there's a difference between like a right-hand path worship and a left-hand path worship. Right-hand path worship is it's what you'd expect in like a monotheistic religion. It's where you put yourself as below. It's like this very inferior feeling when you worship one. Whereas I noticed the left-hand path worships at almost an equal level. And because the definition for worship can also mean just to idolize and look at in high regard. It doesn't mean I am so inferior. We literally have Belial, who is the one without a master, and he has been known to test people to make sure they will stand up for themselves. Incredible, incredible mentor. But I have come to realize that I love worshiping the demonic. Like I find so much joy in celebrating the rites in dedicational prayers towards them, but that there is no way that I feel inferior to them at all, because one, they don't make me feel inferior at all, and two, I just don't see myself as that. I see myself as someone worth worshiping. Just as they are worth worshiping. I'm worth, like, I don't mean like I need followers and I need people to give me, no, not at all, but I don't need other people to worship me but myself. As long as I'm aware of my self-worth, I am, by doing that, worshiping myself. As long as I just, like, perform self-love, I am worshiping myself by seeing myself in a higher regard. Because in our society, like, there's a lot of, like, self-hatred. And so I absolutely do not see anything wrong at all with worshiping the demonic divine.
Yeah, and worshiping the demonic divine, it's like you said, it's absolutely wonderful. I would say that I worship them as well, but as you do, I also worship myself and I don't see myself as inferior at all. But when I have talked to people in multiple occult communities who are like more like beginner demonologists, and I've said, well, I think technically we do worship demons, then they get very mad. I think that, well, Corellia was there at one point when I was speaking to someone in a public community about the worship of demons, but it's happened to me a couple other times too, where I'll say, I mean, I worship demons, and I think that if you look at a couple different definitions of worship and you look at how we like appreciate and cherish and respect the demonic, then it could also be defined as worship. And a lot of demonologists, a lot of people on the left-hand path, are extremely resistant to ever say that they worship any entities. And I think that also definitely comes from an Abrahamic background and religious trauma. Because in many places, when someone doesn't have a good experience with worship, it's because like they think that they have to like give themselves up to a demon, like, oh, like you have complete control over my life. I'm nothing when it comes to like I'm nothing compared to you. And people on the left-hand path are very, very, very against something like that. And they absolutely don't want to call what they do worship. Because all it makes them think of is like that right-hand path definition, which is just like completely submitting yourself, which is like complete submission to the demonic. So yeah, I've seen a lot of resistance when it comes to that definition, and I'd even say that within demonology communities, saying that you worship demons is kind of seen as taboo in a couple communities.
Definitely. And as we move on from the topic demons, well, we're still in the topic of demons, we're moving on to our fifth misconception, which is you cannot work with demons and angels. Our fifth and final misconception. I think it definitely depends on the practitioner. I think if you are a very like Christian, like you're not a Christian pagan, but you're just very a Christian witch, yeah, there might be some instances where you genuinely cannot work with the demonic because it is against your religious practice. But there's also the existence of Christian pagans who are very like open to working with the demonic because they don't see them as evil. Or you have people who work with angels who aren't even Christian. It's very possible. Angelolaters, for instance. Which is an ironic term because angels weren't really ever meant to be worshipped. And yet angelolatry is considered the worship of angels. So, but umbrella term, people will just call it working with angels. As demonologists, I definitely know some people who will steer clear of angels in their entirety because they just don't feel comfortable. Maybe they're still getting over some religious trauma. But there's also a fair amount of demonologists who are very comfortable working with the angels. Are very comfortable working with both demons and angels at the same time. Sometimes because of this is a pretty shared gnosis. Sometimes because of like the vast difference in energies, they may have to like schedule out times. But that usually will happen when you start mixing in different pantheons of like deities, where you have like the energies just feel really different. So you really have to like schedule your things properly, or else you're gonna have two completely incompatible energies in the room that just end up really tiring you out. Just like working with like four complete fire demons in a room would feel like you really have to balance it out, and balance is going to be really important in any part of your craft. But from my perspective, you can if you want to. There's really nothing stopping you. I work with both angels and demons, and I've had absolutely zero issues. Sure, some of them just don't energetically merge as well, but some of them get along like really well with each other. And I, other than just separating their altars, I really haven't run into a lot of problems when it comes to working with the both of them. And I've been able to learn just as valuable lessons from both demons and angels. I've been able to forge really close relationships with both of them. And I'm really glad that I've had the honor to work with the two of them pretty closely.
Yeah, and a lot of like the belief that you can't work with both demons and angels definitely comes from the myth of Lucifer's fall, that he did not want to submit to God and he left heaven along with multiple other angels who became demons. and therefore they believe that like angels and demons absolutely despise each other. Which is, I mean, I guess I could kind of see the logic behind it, but as you said before, as someone who's interacted with both angels and demons, they absolutely don't hate each other at all. They just have slightly conflicting energies. But yeah, there's also just like that belief just comes from the story of the fall, which did actually originate in a work of fiction, Paradise Lost. That's where the idea that Lucifer is a fallen angel comes from. What was I gonna say? So yeah, so I think that belief that you can't work with both of them just comes from the story of the fall and the belief that they absolutely hate each other, when that really isn't very true, as you can see with so many people's experiences with both the demonic and the angelic.
I personally always seen the angels as like not working under like Yahweh the God, working under the source. And I think, you know, kind of like the original divine source, like that's kind of like my own thing. I see them basically worshiping magic, just everything. The all. And that's kind of where I s that's kind of always how I've like identified them. As and it's definitely like been a definition that works for me, and it won't always work for everyone else. But I know some people who orient God as the all, the universe. And so in by that sense, like it makes sense for me to consider that in the context of me working with angels, that they, rather than convincing me to worship God, the Christian God, they're convincing me to worship like the universe, the all. And as I said earlier, it's good to worship those, like we kind of like worship those higher forces while worshiping ourselves at the same time. We're gonna move on to Kemeticism.
All right, so our first topic is periods and practice. So, within Kemeticism, within ancient Egypt, blood was seen as extremely unclean, and the gods absolutely hate blood within like traditional Kemeticism. And you can't really, like, according to many people, you can't or shouldn't interact with the gods if you are bleeding, whether it be because of a period, or because like you have a cut, you have a gash somewhere, and it's still actively bleeding. It's pretty common practice to say that like you can't interact with the gods, or you'll make the gods very, very unhappy by interacting with them while actively bleeding. And I would have to say that this belief is probably existed due to probably it stemmed from health concerns. Out of anything, it definitely probably stemmed from health concerns within ancient Egypt. Egypt, can't speak. Because of course medicine back then was much less advanced than it is now, and their understanding of blood and infections was far more primitive compared to what we know now. So I believe that it wasn't it isn't that blood is offensive to the gods, or it's not sacred to the gods. It's because you don't want someone who's actively bleeding contaminating ritual space, or like offering perfumes and like chemicals and things like that to the gods while also actively bleeding. Because they could contaminate offerings, they could hurt themselves further. So, I think that many people believe that the gods just absolutely dislike blood because they think it's like revolting. But I don't think that makes sense when there are so many Kemetic deities of the slaughter, of the bloodbath, of the massacre, of carcasses, like everything that I just listed are all epithets of different gods. And in mythology, there are many deities who, like for example, Sekhmet, became enraged when she saw that the people weren't following the laws of Maat, so she began to slaughter them, and she was drinking their blood. And obviously, if a deity was like within mythology, for days on end slaughtering people and drinking their blood, obviously they don't think that blood is something that's revolting or dishonorable to have presented to them or in front of them. So I think that really, if you look at mythology and you look at just like the differences in culture, then it doesn't make that much sense for people to think that you absolutely cannot interact with deities while you're bleeding, or that deities will be mad with you. Because I've seen so many people, so many like beginner Egyptian pagans, or even very advanced Egyptian pagans, get so anxious and so scared because they just gave an offering to a deity while they had a paper cut or something. And I think that that's definitely an extremely large misconception. I've seen so many people be so scared that their deity is going to be enraged with them, angry with them, because they interacted with them or gave them an offering or even spoke about them while like actively bleeding or having a wound, which is just like a gigantic misconception that I see. And also, another really big piece of information that I see being spread in Kemetic communities is that you cannot interact with Kemetic deities while you are on your period, because in ancient Egypt, like you should not have been interacting with Kemetic deities on your period. And I think that that does stem from a bit of misogyny within ancient Egypt, because period blood was seen as like extremely like unclean, like not okay, like something that's just like revolting, when it really isn't revolting or unclean at all. It's just like a normal bodily function. So I think that the belief that you cannot interact with the gods, or the gods will become angry at you if you interact with them while you're in this state of uncleanliness, is just stems from misogyny, but also probably has some roots in health concerns. Again, they probably didn't have as like advanced technology as we do, so you wouldn't want like someone who's actively bleeding to come in and contaminate a ritual space, a temple, get blood on any kind of clothes or like offerings or anything like that. So I think that in a modern context, interacting with deities, with Kemetic deities, while you're bleeding, while you're on your period, is totally fine, because there's far less of a risk of you, like contaminating ritual space, contaminating offerings while you're bleeding, just because we have tampons, we have pads, we have like band-aids, bandages, and just in a modern context and looking at mythology, it's really not that big of a deal if you interact with deities, because there are so many deities that just in mythology, like revel in blood, are all about the massacre, are all about war. And I think it's a little bit silly to think that a deity of war and the bloodbath and slaughter, a deity who is like a patron of pharaohs in battle, would be disgusted by a paper cut. And that's a belief that I see very widely spread within Kemetic communities.
Especially because like it's kind of opposite in demonology. Like in demonology, a lot of like they really like well, demonology, modern demonology compared to like ancient pagan, ancient Kemeticism, a lot of demonologists, especially the those of us who bleed, we have this highlight on our blood, and we'll hear about a lot of like uterus holding demonologists who will offer their blood, like their period blood, as a blood offering. And I honestly, I don't know why I haven't done that yet. I think I've just been really scared to clean up the mess that that's gonna cause. But I think it's really interesting to see like the complete opposites that exist when it comes to how different traditions view blood.
Yeah, it's such a stark contrast, because within demonolatry, blood is seen as like such an important and such a sacred offering to give, because it's you, it's your life force, it's what's pumping in your veins, it's what's keeping you alive, it's what's giving you the gift of life. But like in Kemeticism, it's like it's seen as unclean, it's seen as like an insult to the gods if you were to do something like offer them blood. So yeah, so the view on blood is very, very, very different. In different cultures and in different traditions, and that's super interesting to look at. Okay, so our next comedic misconception revolves around darker deities and death deities. And this brings in my favorite, extremely taboo topic, which is those who work with, oh, I'm gonna say it, I'm gonna say his name. It's very, that would scare very many Egyptian pagans half to death. Apophis or Apep. So I'll just give a little bit of an introduction to who Apep is. So this is going to be a very, very, very basic way to just give an introduction to like an understanding of who he is. So he could be seen as like how Christians view Satan. Like Satan is to like traditional Christianity how Apep or Apophis is to traditional Kemeticism. So Apophis is seen as like the deity of all destruction. He's a gigantic serpent who craves chaos, who creates all chaos and all destruction, and wants to swallow the sun, who wants to swallow the deity Ra, and who wants to plunge the world into darkness. And every Kemetic, well, I mean, I haven't met, I've only met like one or two people who don't do this. But those are people who are also demonolaters and people within the draconian tradition, but they won't even spell out his name. Like even people who aren't Kemetics, even people who are like Hellenics, who are like witches, who are like of like so many completely different forms of paganism, they will not spell out his name. They will slash it, even when referring to him with like pronouns, him or it, they will slash the pronouns. Or they'll call him the snake and they'll slash out snake when referring to him. And this is because in Kemeticism, words have extreme power. So even like a way to like honor or do a devotional act for a deity is just rejoice in their name, say their name, spread the word about them. And they believe that saying his name or spelling out his name without slashing it is giving him power. So they won't even say his name. And they won't even like allow pronouns or words referring to him to be written out without it being slashed. So many Kemetic pagans are absolutely just absolutely terrified of Apophis, of Apep, and they all really, really, really dislike him. And I think it is pretty ironic when I will meet so many Kemetic practitioners who absolutely hate Apophis and who are absolutely offended by any for like by the thought of anybody worshiping with or working with him because they see him as just like so completely evil. And yet they see absolutely no problem with anybody working with demons or worshiping demons or Satan or Lucifer, who in like popular mythology and within like the Ars Goetia are seen as like holy evil spirits. Like somehow they're completely okay with people working with these entities who are historically and even still to this day seen as completely evil, but they're absolutely not okay with anybody working with Apophis. So I think that that's there's a little bit of it's very ironic that they absolutely cannot see anybody working with Apophis, but then absolutely be okay with other people working with what would be the equivalent of Apophis within Christianity. And what was I gonna say? So yes, they absolutely can see how Lucifer or Satan can be seen in a positive light, but they cannot see how Apophis could be seen in a positive light. And I guess I'll explain how he can be seen as like, well, I mean, I guess a not completely evil deity. I will quote what he said to Corellia, which is, embrace destruction, survive destruction, become destruction, so that when I come to swallow your son, you have no trouble swimming through the darkness. So when it comes to working with Apophis as a positive deity, when it comes to worshiping him, he's very, very much about throwing you headfirst into the ocean to teach you how to swim. He manifests quite the amount of destruction and change into your life, but it's all so that you can just learn from it, survive past it. Like working with him, beliefs that you previously thought to be cemented and at the core of your practice will be completely turned upside down. But after you've survived, like, your core beliefs being turned upside down, your new beliefs will be even more solidified and will serve you even better. So he is, you know, very big on chaos, very big on destruction, but he can bring that positive destruction, those flames of rebirth into your life. And as someone who works with Apophis and also works with Kemetic deities, who are absolutely supposed to hate each other, I would say it's very much like how we spoke about angels and demons. They absolutely do not hate each other. The Kemetic deities that I do work with do, like, understand how he can be seen in a positive light, and they understand how the destruction that he brings into one's life is can be so positive and, like, so wonderful. Like, when Apophis came into my life, he did bring about a lot of destruction, but that destruction brought me so much closer to Sekhmet. Sekhmet is a deity that is supposed to, like, in mythology, is supposed to, kill Apophis. But he has brought me so much closer to her. And, like, they don't mind each other, they don't hate each other, they understand each other, and really all I need to do is keep them separate, because again, that energy really does clash and does give me a headache if I have them in the room at the same time. But just when it comes to my experiences and the experience of so many other people, it's absolutely fine to work with both him and Kemetic deities, or just work with him, because he can be such a positive influence. And I have never gone into a Kemetic community where I have not seen at least, like, a dozen people be absolutely horrified and disgusted by anybody even thinking of worshipping a Pep. So that is an extremely, extremely taboo topic, and a misconception around a Pep.
Yeah, I think, like, the topic of a Pep is so... It honestly, we can both kind of talk about it for another hour. And I, like, have my own experiences with it. My borderline is, like, I try not to talk about it that much because I'm not a Kemetic. So, I'm not a Kemetic. I don't have the right. I really don't have that much of a right to talk about it. The only reason I do is because I can only talk about it in a draconian right, in a draconian light. But I can't talk about it because Apophis is part of, like, the draconian tradition. But I can't talk about it in a Kemetic light. All I really have to say is, like, one of my first, like, impressions of, like, learning about Apophis was from practitioners who definitely weren't Kemetic in the slightest, did not research any of their texts, and were telling me, a non-Kemetic, how to, like, slash his name and kind of, like, demeanor and degrade him. I think that if you're Kemetic, you have all the right in the world to slash the name. Like, it is your practice, you are following your traditions, go for it. And if you're a Kemetic who doesn't slash it, it's fine, that's you. But if you practice absolutely zero Kemeticism, I hate to say this, but, like, you don't really have that much of a say. It's not your practice, why are you so worried about what you're bringing into your life if you know you're not part of it? I mean, I understand it if you're, like, hell-bent on avoiding that destruction, but if you're gonna be hell-bent on avoiding deities that cause destruction, you're gonna have to slash out the names of a lot of entities in your path, you know?
And you're going to have to avoid, like, half of the Kemetic pantheon if you're that afraid of chaos and destruction. And also, what I wanted to say is, like, people are so extremely afraid of Apophis. Like, someone said that they saw his name written unslashed and it made them physically ill, which is, like, personally, I could never understand being okay with living in such fear of an entity. Like, if I was that afraid of an entity, I would absolutely not be happy with myself, because I don't want to fear something that horribly, that does not make me feel good about myself, that does not make me feel powerful in my practice. And I think that one of the main reasons that people are so adamant about no one working with Apophis, about Apophis being pure evil and nothing else, is because that fear is so comforting. It creates, like, a bubble. It allows someone to absolutely hate something, just throw all of their hatred at something, and just be so afraid of something so that they can find protection, they can find happiness, they can find security in their deities that will protect them from this absolute evil. So I think that one of the reasons that so many people are like so adamant about continuing the fear of Apep is because fearing him is so comforting, because you have these deities here who will take care of you, who will protect you from him no matter what, and it allows people who usually would present themselves like as very, very strong, like very, very like unpenetrable people who like are never afraid of anything. It gives them an outlet for all of their fears that they cannot show in any other context, for all of their fears and all of their angers and all of their anxieties, because everybody is afraid of Apophis. Everybody is supposed to be afraid of Apophis, and I'm not supposed to be afraid of anything, because that's, because a lot of people, especially, like, men, like, if we're getting on the topic of toxic masculinity, like, they're not supposed to be afraid of anything. They're not supposed to show, like, sadness or anxiety or negative emotions, and the hatred, the extreme hatred of Apep allows so many, like, emotionally damaged and emotionally closed off people to have, like, finally this one outlet for all of their hatred and anger and anxiety, and gives them one outlet for them to be vulnerable, which is why I think so many people are so adamant in keeping that outlet there, in keeping that fear of Apep, so that they can hate something, they can be vulnerable, they can fear something without being judged. And our next topic, oh yeah, chronic illnesses and practice. So we did talk about this a little bit before when we were talking about bleeding in practice and periods in practice. So generally, while very many people say that you're not supposed to interact with Kemetic deities at all while you're bleeding, some people, like a good amount of people, also keep that same rule when it comes to interacting with them at all when you are sick. But this is really, well, that makes things like extremely inaccessible for people who have chronic illnesses. Because like if you have a chronic illness, I know there are multiple chronic illnesses where you are technically constantly bleeding, or you are constantly ill, you're constantly like dealing with like pain, you're always sick, and the belief that you, that like your ritual uncleanliness, your bleeding, your illness, something that chronic, that people with chronic illnesses have to live with for their entire lives, for their entire existence, and just the belief that like this blood, this illness is unclean and offensive to the gods, creates the narrative that like people who suffer of these chronic illnesses, like their very existence is offensive to the gods. And that is quite the misconception, because I have seen many beginners, even advanced people, still have doubts about this. Like scared that the gods won't accept them, the gods won't love them because they have a chronic illness, and you're not supposed to, like, according to very many people, you're not supposed to interact with the gods while you're dealing with this chronic illness. So I think that, like, again, like, speaking about how I think that this belief that blood is completely, completely unclean comes from just medical concerns and concerns around contamination and, very little knowledge about how diseases are spread. So I think that, again, this belief that you cannot interact with the gods when you're sick, when you're bleeding, just doesn't really stem from the gods seeing anything like that as unclean or revolting. It comes from ancient Egypt not having the most advanced medical technologies and medical understanding. So again, it's completely fine for people with chronic illnesses to interact with deities and interact and worship them and like rejoice in them and work with them. Because again, there are so many deities of chaos, destruction, death, carcasses, massacres. And if they can handle a massacre, like having the epithet like Lord of Carcasses, then they can handle someone with a chronic illness, and they can totally like interact with someone and look past a chronic illness. So that's my belief, that it's totally fine for somebody who is actively bleeding or somebody who is dealing with a chronic illness to interact with the gods. And again, I see so many beginners and so many people afraid that they are disrespecting the gods and like revolting them just by interacting with them in the state that they always are by dealing with a chronic illness. And that brings me to the very last misconception, which is interpreting the laws of Ma'at in a modern concept, in modern context. So just for a little bit of context, the laws of Ma'at are like, you know, like they're like, you know, like how there's the Ten Commandments, there's a version of the Ten Commandments in every religion, like in Hellenism, there's the Delphic Maxims. Well, in Kemeticism, there are the 42 laws of Ma'at. Ma'at is the Kemetic goddess of justice. She is portrayed with wings, much like Isis is, and it is her feather, like one of her feathers, that your heart is weighed against once you die. Within like the Kemetic beliefs of the afterlife, most people probably already know this, but it is believed that once you die, you have to go up to Anubis, and he weighs your heart against a feather, and that feather is the feather of Ma'at, the goddess of justice. And if your heart is heavier than the feather, that means that you have not been a good person, and your heart is devoured by the goddess or demoness Ammit, and you forever live in restlessness, and you cannot pass on to the afterlife. So there's your context for who Ma'at is. And the 42 laws of Ma'at, and like I will say this about every single like religious doctrine, set of rules in a religion. If you're not an asshole, if you're not a prick, then you're already basically, then you're already following all of their rules. But there are many of the laws of Ma'at which are very odd to when bring into a modern context. So for one of them, I'll be talking about the 14th law of Ma'at. I have not felt sorrow without reason. Now, this is an interesting law of Ma'at because, again, like I have spoken before about like the belief that Kemetic deities find blood revolting probably just stems from like blood, like people not being able to manage blood very well, not wanting contamination, because of a much more primitive understanding of medicine and biology. And when it comes to the 14th law of Ma'at, I have not felt sorrow without reason. This could definitely be seen as something criticizing, like, depression or chronic depression. Because depression is, well, feeling sorrow without reason all the time. And this law of Ma'at would make sense in a culture where depression and mental health is not understood, where it's not. Where like mental illnesses aren't understood, aren't like accepted as illnesses, because I mean we're talking about ancient Egypt. So this is one law of Ma'at that really can be interpreted very oddly in a modern context. And another law of Ma'at would be the need to respect the pharaoh and the pharaoh's family. Well, I mean, very obviously, there is no pharaoh in the modern age, and very many people absolutely do not respect the equivalent of the pharaoh, or like the like political leaders. Very many people do not respect them or see them very highly, and I think it can be it's very obvious that the laws of Ma'at are, if not wholly, are partially human-made, are human-made laws, because when it comes to having to respect the pharaoh no matter what, there are definitely a couple issues with that. Because like, what if the political leader is genuinely a bad person, if they're like working against certain rights for certain people? You cannot like, and you should not have to respect and bow down to a political leader without question, which is what one of the laws of Maat is asking, which is a law of Maat that is obviously human made and created by pharaohs or royal families to stay in power. So when it comes to the laws of Maat in a modern context, I'd say there's definitely very many that can be, well, I mean, overlooked, that do not have to be followed, because again, these are human-made laws, a couple of which were created based on a less advanced understanding of the world, and also created to serve people in higher up positions. So misconception, I'd say, is that many people say you absolutely have to follow all of the laws of Ma'at if you want to work with Kemetic deities. You absolutely need to follow them, and you will enrage them if you don't. But now that I've spoken about so many, like a couple of the laws that don't make sense in a modern context that are obviously human-made and made to benefit systems that are no longer in place, it's untrue that like you absolutely need to follow these laws, because they don't, many of them don't make sense in a modern context. So I think that you abs that someone that you should absolutely take into consideration some of the laws of Ma'at, which really, if you look at them, it's just basic respect, basic human decency. It's like, don't steal food from children, don't disrespect the gods. So yes, I'd say that you absolutely should follow many of the laws of Ma'at, because it's basic respect, basic human decency. But also many of them can be forgotten and just seen as human made to serve, again, institutions that are archaic and no longer in place in the modern world.
I think going back to that that law about hierarchy and authority, I definitely see why that would conflict when you're practicing demonolatry and Kemeticism. For someone who's trying to stay loyal to the laws of Ma'at, would find they I'm sure they would find a bit of conflict when demonolatry asks you to constantly question. Well, at least this is the case in Luciferianism. You have to constantly question your authority and constantly like be skeptic over who is in power in order to ensure that the person that is in power is genuinely fit to be in power, because there's a saying that the king should be for the people, not the people should be for the king. And I think in the way that applies to what you've been saying, this podcast episode went a lot longer than we had anticipated with our minimum of 20 minutes. But it was very fun talking to you, Valkyrie. I learned a lot of things about Kemeticism that I definitely did not know at the start of this. I'm your host, Corellia.
And I'm your host, Valkyrie.
And thank you for listening to the first episode of Oracles of the Occult. We'll see you next time.